You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This is a rare occasion. I've identified myself as Mike Silverblatt, God knows why. I'm here in the studio today with Julian Barnes, author of A History of the World in 10.5 chapters, his newest book, recently published by Knopf. His earlier books include Staring at the Sea, Flaubert's Parrot. Those are the ones I think he's most famous for in America. And Before She Met Me and Metroland, a satirical novel sort of following from In the Footsteps of Evelyn Waugh. A History of the World in 10.5 chapters has a happy relation to our theme song. That is that this is a show that opens with a song sung by a cricket. A History of the World in 10.5 chapters is a book whose first chapter is narrated by a woodworm. This woodworm is a stowaway on Noah's Ark. His depredations make repeated appearances throughout the history of the world as they go on. What suggested this novel to you? Where did it begin?
I think books are a bit like teeth. When you pull them out, you sometimes find there's only one root, and you sometimes find that they're great fat molars and they've got about 3 or 4 roots. This is very much a 3 or 4 root tooth book. Part of it came from several different directions. Part of it, the first chapter to which you've alluded, which is a sort of burlesque description of life on the ark as seen by a woodworm or termite, came out of a crazy plan I had after Flaubert's Parrot, which was to use the narrator of Flaubert's Parrot, an elderly gentleman called Geoffrey Braithwaite. He had this plan to rewrite the entire Bible, and I was going to write Geoffrey Braithwaite's Guide to the Bible for Modern Use, which would be like those. Every so often you come across a really good guidebook to a city which tells you not to do things rather than to do things. There's a very good guidebook to Venice by a man called J.G. Lynx, which says, down the alley to your right you will see an interesting-looking church. It isn't, in fact, interesting, so have a cup of coffee on the left instead. And I was going to do something like that on the Bible. I realized it was a sort of probably an impossible project. So, but part of that boiled down into the first chapter, which sort of unpacks the myth of Noah. And 2 or 3 of the other bits of the book came from earlier, larger ideas. For instance, there's a central chapter about the painting of Jericho's Raft of the Medusa, and I had an idea at one time to do a whole book on the painting. Fortunately, I didn't. I mean, I'm not an art historian by training. So sort of these ideas and themes sort of attenuated themselves gradually. All this was going on while I was writing a previous book, because I always, at some level of my brain, I'm working on the next one while I'm writing the one I'm writing. And then at some point, the idea coagulates, I guess. It 2 or 3 things floating around, 2 or 3 roots on the tooth suddenly start joining up, and then you're away. But when actually that moment is, you tend to forget in the writing of it.
We're talking about A History of the World in 10.5 chapters by Julian Barnes. As the book proceeded, this book, which takes the form of variations on the theme of human destructiveness and destiny, I expected the plot to thicken. At first it seems like that kind of book, the Calvino novel in which characters from the first chapter reemerge in the fourth to meet characters from the second. Instead, the book thins as it proceeds rather than thickens. Am I intuiting a once upon a time different intention?
No, absolutely not. I jib slightly at thins. I'm not. I mean, it's organized. It's deliberately organized in the way that it is organized. It has 10.5 chapters, but there's no continuity of chronology or character in it. There is, as you observe, a woodworm which, or a series of woodworm, who can tell if it's the same one, which occasionally reappear through the chapter, but that's the only continuous character. No, the joins and the narrative muscle is done in terms of images and repeated themes and repeated patterns of human aspiration. So the reader is asked to do some work in this book. I mean, the reader is, I hope, given a lot of pleasure at the time while being asked to do a bit of work between chapters to make the links for him or herself. I mean, I see it as a book which thickens as it goes along, but doesn't thicken in the way that perhaps you anticipate.
Yes, it begins, and I thought, oh, well, this will be an Ulipo sort of book, you know, one whose construction has certain rules that begin to be apparent and then intensify themselves, like something of Queneau's, really, or even the kind of thing in Nabokov's Pale Fire. Then its aspirations seem to become less complexly literary and more intensely moral human. Is it, for all of its destructive intimations, pessimistic intimations, is it essentially a humanist book?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't know if authors should be allowed to answer questions like, are you a humanist, like, are you a pessimist, or are you an optimist, which we do tend to get asked. It's going back to what you said at the beginning of that question. It's certainly true that this isn't a games playing book. I mean, it isn't an intellectual exercise. I mean, books are about life rather than about other books, it seems to me. And so while there are elements of sort of parody and play in it, it's meant to center on the experience of life rather than the experience of other things. So the sort of the Kano side of it, which you might think about at the beginning, as you observe, goes away quickly. Am I a humanist? Pass.
The final two chapters, although perhaps the most ironic, seem gentled. There certainly are not grisly punishments in store for the characters, except if being the victim of your own imagination is a punishment. So I thought that the book was going in an optimistic, if not humanistic, direction.
Yes, I see your reading of it now. Yes, it's probably true that the last two chapters take a sort of lighter and more satirical tone than some of the earlier stuff that had gone before. I mean, the heaven chapter is about it's a man who dreams he goes to heaven. I dreamt that I woke up. It is the oldest dream of all. It begins, and I've just had it. Many parts of the book, starting with Noah, obviously, is about man's spiritual aspirations and religious aspirations. And so I decided to end it with a sort of modern-day heaven. And while it's in one sense it's a sort of light comic takeoff of heaven, it's also meant to have a certain underlying sadness to it, because this is what we've reduced the idea of heaven to in our modern age. When this guy gets to heaven, the idea is not that you get the heaven that you deserve, which is or the afterlife that you deserve, which is the old idea, but that you get the one that you want. And so he gets to heaven, and everything he wants is fulfilled. As he goes on, he finds that getting what you want is, in a funny way, unfulfilling. But there are people still around, very few of them, who are called old heaveners. An old heaven, which was the heaven of the spirit and the soul, has sort of gone out of fashion, because people are hooked on corporeality their idea of heaven. I mean, this is my rough generalization of 20th century Western civilization's view of heaven. Their view of heaven is that it should be, you know, pretty much like Earth, and that you stay roughly the same, except, you know, maybe you have a little bit of cosmetic surgery or your tennis game's a bit better, and so on and so forth. But the idea of you know, losing your body and actually just having a sort of spirit is just sort of that's gone. That's not what we want anymore. And so this guy gets what he wants. And then realizes that, as someone observes to him, getting what you want all the time, after a while, begins to feel like not getting what you want.
In this book, human history seems to be dependent or judged by man's cruelty to animals. The woodworm suggests that Noah has been like the Nazis in eliminating species, and as the book progresses, it would seem that animals have a kind of special weather vane quality. We can assess a culture by their treatment of animals. Does that make any sense? I wondered whether the man who had written Flaubert's Parrot.
Yes, I've cornered the novelistic market in animals at the moment. I think, yes, it's funny. I think more and more animals came sort of crowding on board my book as I went on. At first, I thought I would just have an arc load, and as you point out, I mean, a lot of things that happen on my arc, my version of the arc, prefigure what happened subsequently. I mean, there's an alternative version of evolution, which is propounded in the first chapter, which is that the huge gaps between from one species to another, which we've come to explain by Darwinist natural selection, are more easily explained by the fact that Noah ate quite a lot of animals that were on board the ark to start off with, and threw some of them overboard because he didn't like them, and so on. Yes, I guess it's not an infallible rule, but people's treatment of animals is often a touchstone of their character, seems to me. And we haven't got a very good record on the whole, have we, with animals?
It seems the worm has it correctly when he says, we didn't make eating one another a judgment. The animals eat one another, but they're not really mean by it. They do it because they have to live. Whereas man, in this book at least, seems to be running riot over the natural world, and in his depredations, announcing his judgment.
Yes, another point that the woodworm makes towards the end of his chapter, when he tries to sort of sum up what he learned about Noah and Noah's family on the ark, was that the difference, main difference between man and the animals, is that the animals are fully evolved, and that they are what they are, and that they do what they do, and you don't expect, you know, a dog to suddenly moo, or a sheep to bark. Whereas he says this is what humans are like. You know, they're still at a fairly primitive. They're very clever in many ways, and they can solve lots of problems. But in terms of evolution, they're still at a very early stage. And that what they're doing is, you know, they're the cow that barks. They're the dog that moos.
Yes, and like certain authors, they are capable of anything. I've been talking to Julian Barnes, the author of History of the World in 10.5 Chapters, recently published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Our second guest today is Kazuo Ishiguro, whose novel, The Remains of the Day, has just been published by Alfred A. Knopf. Some months ago, I got a call from Ann Beattie, whose work and whose opinions I like, who left a message on my machine saying that she'd read a perfect novel. Well, of course, the bookworm's ears perked up. A perfect novel. Well, where do you find them? And Anne, sadistically and typically, didn't tell me what it was. Then began the exchange of calls between Virginia and California, message machines. What was this perfect book? The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro, she said, read it immediately. But it wasn't published yet, and so I called the people at Knopf who sent me The Galleys. And the book has been circulating around America in galleys prior to its publication. And writers as different as Anne Beattie and Richard Ford, Salman Rushdie, Michael Ondaatje, Frederick Bush, Michael Hare, have all come up in chorus to recommend it. Probably the only chorus of praise of this sort that I can recall came for the novel Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson. And in a certain way, the books are similar in that they are very individual. This book is about a butler who is touring England in after, really, the fall of empire, re-examining his life and the traditions that are instilled in a butler, and kind of looking out at the end of the day and the end of his day. Kazuo Ishiguro has been living in London since he was six. Is this in some way, which seems to be a novel about reticence, and so it seems to me to be in a double sense a commentary on England and its codes of behavior, but also in an odd way a commentary on, say, Japanese literature and perhaps its reticence or formality. Most people talking about the book speak of it as if it were a book aimed only at the British scene at the end of the empire. Is there a Japanese influence in the book as well?
Well, I'm sure there is, but when I sit down to write, these kind of questions aren't really foremost in my mind. I've never tried to actually deliberately put in Japanese influences, or even to try and get in touch with whatever the Japanese roots are in my writing in imagination. When I sit down to write, I just try and write the best book I can. But I suppose inevitably this book will reflect who I am, and the voice that speaks will in some senses be a multicultural one, or at least a dual cultural one. I've been brought up by Japanese parents, although I've really grown up in an entirely English environment outside of the home. But obviously one's parents cast a big influence on the way one thinks and behaves. And indeed the strategies over things like emotion and so on, which might amount to this reticence that you actually suggest there, that might possibly come from something Japanese or something from Japanese culture. But that's not something I'm particularly conscious of when I write. It's only afterwards when readers or critics look at my books and they say, yes, there's a Japanese, says there's some sort of Japanese echo, or there's something that you can tie in with a Japanese tradition, that I start to think, well, maybe there is. But it's not something, as I said, I try to work in. And at the thematic level, you know, I haven't actually tried to deliberately address English issues or Japanese issues as such. I've just tried to address human issues.
The book has a kind of, one critic, I guess the one for the New York Times, calls it deliciousness, but I would say it's a sneaking deliciousness. There's a feeling at first that the narrator of the novel, Stevens, the butler, is serious, but does the author know how peculiar and how funny he is? Is this one of the famous ironic or unreliable narrators? And gradually, it's not immediate, it creeps up on you how detailed the book is in its comedy. Did the book shape itself as a comic novel for you? Because there is as well, of course, gravity and restraint and great sadness in the book.
I think it's inevitably a comedy, but it's a comedy of the sort that I aspire to. I'm not a big one for jokes just for the sake of jokes. Not in my writing anyway. But there is something funny about the very same things that are tragic about a character like this butler. I mean, the fact that he has very little or no sense of humor is paradoxically very funny. And a lot of the comedy, if you like, I think derives from that fact. It derives from the fact that the narrator has a very limited perspective. But these are the very things that make his life tragic, too.
At a certain point, he prides himself on telling us the story of how, being a good butler, he is not perturbed by even the most extreme accident or interruption, and he boasts and practically crows, it's orchestrated wonderfully, about how he's managed to serve and complete an elaborate meal while his father, also working in the house, also a servant, is dying, and his pride at having brought off this coup of emotional restraint is mirrored by our terrible sadness at knowing that this, perhaps certainly one of the most powerful, overwhelming deaths, the death of a father, has taken second place to the course of a banquet. That clearly is around the most risky section in terms of irony that the book takes. Did you hesitate?
No, that was one of the key scenes that I was working up to. The book is structured on at least two or three climaxes. That was the first of the climaxes. That's one of those moments in which you make a very, very firm statement about what you're doing in the book and what the character is all about. This is a man who has some kind of peculiar idealism. Almost a perverted one, which drives him to turn himself into this almost less than human figure, because he thinks this is what constitutes dignity. This is how he can be a great butler, is to have no human feelings of this sort.
I thought I'd ask you to read a passage about butlers, their tradition and their dignity, that will give the listener an idea of the grave comedy constantly lurking at the corners of this very beautiful and brief book.
Okay, well, let's give it a go. Here's a little paragraph here. It is sometimes said that butlers only truly exist in England. Other countries, whatever title is actually used, have only manservants. I tend to believe this is true. Continentals are unable to be butlers because they are, as a breed, incapable of the emotional restraint which only their English race are capable of. Continentals, and by and large the Celts, as you will no doubt agree, are, as a rule, unable to control themselves in moments of strong emotion, and are thus unable to maintain a professional demeanour other than in the least challenging of situations. If I may return to my earlier metaphor, you will excuse me putting it so coarsely, they are like a man who will, at the slightest provocation, tear off his suit and his shirt and run about screaming. In a word, dignity is beyond such persons. We English have an important advantage over foreigners in this respect, and it is for this reason that when you think of a great butler, he is bound, almost by definition, to be an Englishman.
That's from The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro, published recently by Alfred A. Knopf. Now, such a character, given the graveness, the solemnity of his demeanor and of his speech, is likely to strike us, the way many butlers do, as being cold. And yet there is about him, I guess, a kind of Laurel and Hardy quality. He seems like a character observing the proprieties as of, you know, a silent movie, that if we are going to move this piano up these stairs, we are going to have to do it step by step by step. And the prose begins to reflect that crazy, obsessional concern about the proper ways of doing things. And yet at the end of the book, a kind of warmth, or at least a great melancholy, comes seeping in. Did you know at the beginning of the book that you would be capable of those effects in prose?
Well, I didn't know if I'd be successful or not, and that's a question I still don't know the answer to. But I usually do know where I'm going in a book. I think writers roughly, I mean, this is a terrible generalization, but they do roughly fall into two categories, the ones who like to rely heavily on improvisation in their writing procedure. A lot of people I know do like to put in a blank piece of paper and start and surprise themselves by things that tumble out of the imagination. And then they go back and look at it, shape it, edit it. I find I can't do that. I always need a map and a guidebook before I set off. And this book we're talking about, I mean, it took me 3 years to write, during which time I did very little else. But the first two of those 3 years, I didn't actually write any of the prose that is now in this book. I spent a lot of that time planning, working out the structure, researching, just getting well acquainted with the fictional world in which this book takes place and all the different recesses of this man's mind. So, yeah, when I came to write it, I knew fairly precisely what I intended to do. I think there are advantages and dangers of that approach to writing.
By the end, it's as if meted out to this diminished man, there's a half cupful of beauty, a beautiful sunset, a kind of irradiated twilight. And, you know, when it comes, the beauty of that diminished sense of the world really takes my breath away. And I wanted to thank you for it.
Right, thank you.
I've been talking to Kazuo Ishiguro, whose novel, The Remains of the Day, has just been published by Alfred A. Knopf. This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
You're listening to KCRW Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California.
This is Tim Hauser of the Manhattan Transfer inviting you to join me.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.